Man, fucking chest just cracked really hard. I was just trying to do a celebratory pose, and I felt how old we are in my heart.
Is it a good crack or a bad crack? I mean, I went to my chiropractor acupuncturist this morning.
Chiropuncturist.
Yeah, he like does it all. His name is Dr. Phil. Dr. Phil. No great. Shit, Dr. Phil Trigiani, 60-year-old surfer dude. In incredible shape. He's like, hey, what's up, brother? Let's go. Like, best vibes ever. And he fixes my problems with my back. So
I love that. My wife
show goes, not brought to you by that guy, but just saying, right. He's awesome.
No, I love those. When those come up, when you're like, if I ever got a chance to endorse a thing, I would do it for a low rate because I believe in this thing.
That's right.
This is my weird chiropractor story because I've only been a few times to one ever. And my wife goes to one in the Valley, and she'd been going to her for a while. And she was always talking about her, you know, hey, Alex, you got to go to see Alex, and she's going to help you out with whatever. And I'd be like, ah, I got a thing. She'd be like, Alex, you got to go see Alex. I'm like, okay. And one time she was like, why don't we go together? And this was like after the pandemic stuff kind of eased up. She was seeing people again. She's like, you go meet Alex. I was like, all right, sounds great. And I walk in with her, and Alex comes in, and it's a private little office, and Alex is beautiful, like crazy beautiful, like play a chiropractor on Grey's Anatomy pretty. I'm like, and I'm not gonna lie, dude, I'm a person, you know, I've worked with like a lot of celebrities and stuff, and I don't really get starstruck anymore with anybody. No one really like impresses me, but there's something that really threw me off, because at all the time that she ever talked about this girl, I just, for whatever reason, I was picturing a completely different person. I was just flabbergasted by who I saw, and I was kind of like, quiet. And she was like, at one point she was like, you're going to tell her what you're like, right? Yeah. Like out of a sitcom, I was like, look like an idiot with my jaw on the floor. And then, yeah. And then we did the thing, and it was fine. I straightened up, and then we were driving out later, and I was like, why is everyone in your life so hot? Like your therapist I saw way later. I was like, she's really pretty. And then I saw like her mentor, who was her therapist before that. And I was like, she's like a really pretty. I was like, is it just an LA thing? I was like, how is like every person who's a professional in your life is like, looks like they would play that role on a TV show where it's nines and tens only in that universe. And I was like, in the future, I think you owe me. Just let me know if I'm walking into that. I don't know. I feel like you should tell people.
Heads up. Hotness alert.
I looked stupid, and I kind of blamed her for that. dude, I'm really happy that you're back on the show and talking to me. And I told you last time you were here that I wanted to have you, I didn't want to wait super long, cause I felt like we barely scratched the surface of stuff that we could talk about. So I kind of cooked up a few things that I want to get into with you today. And first of all, I'm drinking, like a gin and tonic here that is fascinating to me. Can I tell you about it as a bartender?
Please do.
Okay. The gin is a limited release Hendrix gin called Flora something. I can't remember. Oh, damn. I wish I should have it, but it's Flora something. And it was like a pink label. And I've been into this new one called Monkey 47 that I told you about.
Tell me about that. Try it. It's good.
It is good. And I love how floral it is. It's very like botanical. And so this one, I was like, oh, Flora. Okay. And then I got elderberry tonic water. Mm. I'm not sure what an elderberry is, but that sounded very floral and botanical to me. So I got the two together and I mixed them. And this is the most interesting gin and tonic I think I've ever had in my whole life.
Elderberry and elderflower are big players in the cocktail world. If you've ever had Saint Germain, back when I started bartending in 2011, it was like it had just hit the scene, and it's this elderflower liqueur, and you add like half an ounce to three quarters of an ounce to a cocktail, and it like makes it extra delicious. And within like a year or two, we started calling it bartender's ketchup, because like for like a period of like 2 years in New York City, everything had Saint Germain in it. Everywhere you fucking went, it had Saint Germain in the cocktails. And it's like the craze is kind of passed, which is why you might, you probably like aren't going to see it everywhere in just the same way anymore. But it is very, very tasty. A little, you know, a little pricey, a very fancy bottle. But yeah, like my first year bartending, we were like putting it, we were using like ketchup, like put it a little Saint Germain in that, put it in the margarita, put it in the old fashioned, put it in, goes with everything. It's good.
I totally missed this thing because as we've talked about before, you and I, okay, this is interesting to me. Maybe we'll actually start here. I thought we were going to start somewhere else, but I think we're going to start here. You and I, if anyone listened to the previous episode or didn't, if you're just listening to episode 2, I very much recommend you go back and listen to Brandon's first one. But if you're just starting here, the one sentence catch up is, he's been my best friend since we were in the fifth grade. And we have had very similar paths by going to similar schools all the way through college, on and off, because I moved, you didn't, for the most part. And one of my favorite things in life, especially that you live in New York and I live in LA, which breaks my heart sometimes, but it also is fascinating because we get to check in and I don't have any siblings. Like, you have siblings. I have almost no siblings. I have one half sister I'm not close with. So for me, it's so fun for us to check in along the way because I don't really have that with anybody else in my family.
Yeah.
That being said, we have very different relationships to alcohol and marijuana in particular, even though we have kind of come up trying them about at the same time and all that goofy shit. But man, I just started drinking in my 30s.
Well, that's probably very good for your brain. So
do you think so?
Yeah. I mean, listen, I think alcohol can be, you know, especially moderation, can be a great tool for socialization. There's this book I read called Drunk, How We Sipped, Danced, and Drank Our Way Into Civilization, all about how like alcohol, how like every civilization pretty much for the most part in human history discovers alcohol and uses it, and how like alcohol allows our prefrontal cortex to chill out so that we can like let our guard down and bond and trust each other and like start drinking drunken bar songs and shit. But you know, physiologically, alcohol's not good for you. you know,
I feel like I celebrated before I started drinking. Like, I literally, like a year and a half before I started making drinking a semi regular habit, it's so funny. I remember sharing an article on social media that was like, study finally shows no amount of alcohol is actually good for you. And I was like, see, fuckers, you're dumb. You're fucking dumb. And out here I am like, but the Hendrix Flora elderberry shit it's quite tasty, I have to say.
Really delicious. My shorthand on like there, like the science shows, you know, like alcohol is not good for you health wise, right, but bonding and creating close relationships with human beings is very good for your health. It shows to be like close relationships with others shows to be like one of the most powerful indicators for long life. And the reality is, alcohol can help with bonding with people. You know, if you're somebody who's like crazy in your head all the time, I feel like I'm doing a
pro alcohol TED talk.
Alcohol and I think one of the main things is like we're all very well aware of the negatives of drinking, and it's not good for your health. It's you know, drunk driving. Like I think we're very well acquainted with how all the bad.
It's harmful, right?
But whenever somebody is like, oh my gosh, you don't understand why I drink. It literally does nothing good for us. It's like, that's a lie. We wouldn't do it if it did nothing good for us. It can help people to let their guard down and bond and like be honest. And
I feel like that's a thing you and I have always been good at recognizing, is when someone insists that a fact is true, but the numbers overwhelmingly obviously support the opposite conclusion, or at least or at least eliminate that one as a possibility. And people being like,
no.
here's a totally random example. And then I want to get back to the drinking thing. Like when people say, oh, that person's not funny, when they're a professional comedian, you and I objectively are like, well, we wouldn't say that about a person. Even if we don't like their jokes, we might say, I don't find them funny. They don't work for me. It's not my thing.
They're not my
whatever.
Vibe.
We would relate it back to our own tastes because we know that's the only thing we're really talking about. But I think it makes people sound so silly when they say things like that. They say these all-encompassing truths about like, yeah, alcohol is just like the worst thing and it's terrible. Or like, what? Why does anybody, even something like, why does anybody like Donald Trump? It's like, well, but they're voting for him though in not small numbers. You know, people have lost elections before by abysmal rates, and he's cheated, but he kind of almost won both times. It's not that far away. Like, there's numbers in your face, and there's such a thing as recognizing that's going on. I think that's true with alcohol. For the sake of time, I want to get back to the helpfulness of alcohol. That being said, when you graduated, this is one of my favorite stories. You ended up getting a job as a bartender that you had for quite a while, which was also an acting job, even though you really didn't know how to bartend.
True. So it's funny. If you went back to 15-year-old Brandon and were like, what are you going to do when you grow up? I think at like 15, 16, I was like, I'm going to be an actor in New York City and I'm going to bartend to pay the bills. It's very realistic, grounded kid. And so whenever I went to New York, I had just had it in my brain. I was like, I want to be a bartender. Like, it's good money. I wanted to do that. And I had set my mind on it. And when I first got to New York, I got a job waiting tables at Red Lobster in Times Square. And I was like, I was pushing to try and be a bartender in a way that I think a lot of people at there were really annoyed by, because they're like, who the fuck is this kid? It just rolls in and like, doesn't he understand the hierarchy here at Red Lobster? You got to pay your dues at Red Lobster to like be a bartender. And they kept jerking me around, telling me, yeah, we're going to, but they're not doing it. And then in May of 2011, I went and saw this show called Sleep No More, which at the time was like the hottest, craziest new thing in New York City. Is this immersive theater thing based on Macbeth and Hitchcock, like six floors. You put on a mask. You can't talk. You go to explore the whole thing. At the time, I barely knew what it was. When I went and saw it, I like only knew that it was just like crazy and new and amazing. And people were like, you got to go see the blood orgy, which is this crazy scene where they're like naked with fake blood and a goat's head and all kinds of crazy shit. And I went and I saw it and it was mind blowingly cool. Afterwards, I'm hanging out in the bar, and over the course of the night, I kind of like started chatting with the bar manager. And at one point he like sent me some shots and I think he thought I was cute. And so I was like, and he was mentioning, yeah, you know, we don't know how long we're going to run if we're opening or not, but I definitely need some more bartenders. And I was like, I'm a bartender. Like, yeah, I bartended in North Carolina while I was in college. Total lie. I did not. I waited tables.
We bartended parties at our house.
We did. We did bartend parties at our house several times.
Like real volume, you know?
Yeah.
There was that one party, the Vegas party, where you and I like worked the bar for like 3 hours.
Oh, yeah. The first time really bartending was my second year of college, when we hosted our first year, second year party, and it was Clue themed. And yeah. So all the first years had to, they all had to be a character from Clue. Obviously, there were like three of each character, like, you know, like three Miss Scarlets, three, you know, Professor Plums or whatever. But I volunteered because I was like, I'm the bartender. I'm going to be the bartender. And I was on that bar for like 4 hours that night. And at like 2 a.m, I like poured myself a drink and was like, bar's open, pour yourself drinks, fuckers. I like wandered off. And then I bartended regularly through college, quote unquote, like with a mind towards, I want to be a bartender in New York. So cut to like me talking to this guy. I've lived in New York for like four months at this point. I moved here in January 2011. And I'm like, and so I'm like, I'm a bartender. Yeah. Like, yeah, I'm a bartender in North Carolina. And he was like, it's like, cool, man. We'll, and this was like on a Tuesday, and he's like, we'll come in next Monday and we'll try you out on a shift. And I was like, absolutely. Great. And I go home and immediately on Facebook was like, I need to learn to bartend ASAP. Who can teach me to bartend? And my fellow classmate, Jasmine Osborne, her boyfriend at the time was working in a like Mexican restaurant in Queens. And he's like, come on in, I'll teach you to bartend. And so I went to his like restaurant, and they, the manager was cool with it. So like I basically worked a shift for free for no tips, and I was cool with it. Then they gave me like some tacos at the end, and he taught me a lot of the basics on how to make a cocktail, and gave me a heads up of like, what are the basic cocktails? Which if you really are a bartender, you would know how to make this. Like, you don't know how to make every cocktail in the freaking world to be a bartender. You do not, right. You don't have to go to bartending school, but if somebody asks for a Manhattan or like, you know, that you should know what a Manhattan is, you know,
right?
A screwdriver, although no one's going to call it that. It's just a vodka orange juice. But I trained, and then I could not get this manager. I like got his email. I emailed him. He wasn't getting back to me. I was doing that thing of not, you know, following up enough, but not being crazy, where I like emailed him and he didn't get back to me for like a day or two or three. And then I emailed him one more time, just like checking in, and he didn't get back to me again.
Thinking, so no way.
I was thinking like, okay, he's kind of ghosting me, but here's the problem for his front. He told me to come in next Monday at 5, and he hasn't counteracted that order. So I'm coming in next Monday at 5. And so like, I remember like running around town trying to get the exact outfit, which was basically pretty easy. It was black, you know, black slacks and a white button up, but I needed suspenders. And at the time, like, I don't know if H&M didn't have them or whatever. So I had to go to like Macy's, and all I could find was suspenders that are designed for pants for suspenders that like have all the buttons, not the clip on with the buttons. Yeah. So I'm like on my way to work on that Monday with these like button on suspenders with pants that do not have buttons, with safety pins, like safety pinning them on the inside. Cause I was like, I'm going to roll up and look like I'm ready to work at this joint. And I showed up, and I remember he was like, oh yeah. And I was like, I'm here to bartend. And he was like, right. Okay. Yeah. Come on in, jump on behind the bar.
Clocked his fuck up of not telling you no, after he kind of was like, I might've overextended that.
Years later, he would tell me that his intention was just bring me in for like an hour and then send me home and like be done with it. But they got so busy, and I was holding my own, and like they had two bartenders on and I was the third, and they needed me all night. They needed me to bartend. And so I worked the entire shift. And then afterwards, we all like went in the back quote unquote office, which was just a hallway filled with boxes. And we're like smoking cigarettes and like talking shit and drinking whiskey and just like shooting the shit until like another hour or two, like ingratiating myself with the, right, with the folks. And then at one point near the end of the night, I look around and I'm like, yeah, man, what is this? It's supposed to be the office? He's like, yeah, it's supposed to be the office. I mean, I don't know. I just got this, you know, got to get it organized. And I was like, do you want some help organizing it? I'll come in tomorrow and just like help you organize this stuff. I'm good with like a drill. We can build some shelves and stuff, like whatever. And he's like, really? And I was like, yeah, man, no problem. And he was like, okay. And so like I came in the next day, helped him organize the office. And then I started getting like one or two bartending shifts a week, and then cut to like 3 or 4 months later in like August or September, and the liquor distribution company Pernod Ricard, that was one of our main suppliers, really liked us because we were selling more absinthe than any other bar in North America. And so they paid for all of our bartenders to go through this Bar Smarts mixology course. And some of the old school bartenders were like, nah, I don't give a shit. But me, I was like, yes. Because I like devoured the whole book about the origins of liquor, how to make cocktails. And then we had to go to an in-person seminar where we're like taste testing vodka at like 11 a.m. Very strange. But then we had to like do an in-person test where they like tell you, they're like, all right, they give you a bar and they're like, okay, make these three cocktails. And you have to like make all of them in front of somebody with somebody watching you. And then, you know, and I like passed and stuff. And like at, then after, you know, doing that for a while, then I was like, ha, I have faked it until I have made it. So
you faked it all the way into like getting paid to be trained beyond just yeah. the job. Like you actually kind of got a little mini bartending school out of it. I love that story so much. Of course, like most stories you'll ever tell on this show, I've probably heard them. I love that story so much. That's why I asked you to tell it. And a couple of things about that that I want to mention. So to give it a little bit more definition for those listening, Sleep No More was an interactive theater piece done in a hotel. And it's basically the way I've described it to people is, it's like going to a museum in the dark, and the museum also includes a play that's happening within the halls of the museum. And part of that play is that the music is really, really loud, like hypothalamus, like bass, house almost music with organs and stuff. And it's so loud that there's no dialogue in this play. So it's a physical play. And that play runs like three times in a row. And then at the end of that, it culminates in one location. But throughout that, the play is happening in all locations in this museum that you're wandering around. And you can pick things up in the museum and look at it and interact with things. And sometimes people from the play will grab you while you're looking at shit in the museum and pull you off over in this weird area that only some people get to go in and show you some weird shit that only some people get to see, and then throw you back into the museum. You're like, I don't know, babe, I don't know where I went. It's quite a trippy thing. It's one of my favorite pieces of theater I've ever seen. And because of you and also my work, for a different reason, at Comedy Central, got to go many times. It's one of my favorite things. And to be a bartender there means not only to be a pretty high volume bartender, but also because it was a very exclusive, hip, trendy show to go to, you've got really high end clientele. You've got celebrities rolling through on a regular basis because they've got to check out this thing I just described that includes, as you mentioned early briefly, a blood orgy, which is essentially, if you want to imagine the scene from Blade at the beginning with the strobe light and they're having a rave, except a couple of chicks are topless. And then all of a sudden, as the lights are flashing, like they're very red. And then it's like the lights go out and there's like, anyway, it's not quite so graphic. But there is nudity in it. It's an intense thing.
There's no sexually explicit content, but there's nudity and like eroticism.
It's European PG-13. That's how I'm going to put it.
You reminded me of like one of the fun story. I remember this. I was bartending in like for my first year or so there. And at one point, this guy walks up to the bar and he's like, I'll take three shots of tequila. And I was like, I listed what we had. And I was and Herradura was like the nicest one we had at the time. And he's like, all right, Herradura. And I was like, just want to let you know, these shots are $14 each. Give you a heads up. You know, because sometimes people can get the sticker price and be like, oh, and he like looks at me like, yeah, like, sure. I was like, okay. I'm gonna swipe his car, give it back to him. He walks away from the bar, and my fellow bartender goes, did you just warn Sting how much the shots were? I didn't recognize him. It was definitely Sting. And I was like, you sure you want to pay $14 a shot, Sting?
He like walked away. He's like, I'll be watching you.
And working there also taught me, you know, I liked to believe like, oh, I never get starstruck. You know, I'm so cool. I never get starstruck. Bullshit.
Yeah.
Bullshit. Like right. There are people, but it kind of surprised me, the ones, because it's all the people that mean a lot to you. Like Sting, didn't even recognize him. Psh, whatever. But like when I saw like Jennifer Carpenter, who played like,
she's on Dexter.
Dexter's sister, Deb. I was like, had my head down and I look up and she's like right there. And it's like, I've spent so many hours looking at your face watching this show, and you have no idea who I am. But I was, right. I was like, hey, blah, blah. Can I get a drink? Yes. What would you like?
My favorite thing about meeting celebrities, I think, is from Neil Brennan, who says, no one acts normal around celebrities. Nobody does. Everybody is doing their best impression of a normal person when they're around a celebrity, and we're all just differently good at it.
Yeah.
Some people can pass and it's like, oh man. And I think I'm one of those people after conditioning of having to do it over and over again, all these weird shows with different celebrities. And also I kind of worked in the, like, they used to be a celebrity business for quite a while. And I have old taste. So I'm hanging out with, like, I don't know. I'm trying to think of some. I'm the only 30-year-old who thinks Mr. T is a really cool guy to meet. You know, and everybody else is like, I don't get it. I'm like, I don't have time to explain it to you, but to me, this is really great. But even then, you get around that situation, you do it enough times, you kind of start to figure out your impression of what normal is. But there's, I don't think it ever totally goes away, because that's what happens. Like you said, it is purely the time you've spent engaged with them and taking in whatever it is they do, listening to their song, looking at their face. And then when it's finally in front of you in a tangible way, you're like, man, you're right there. That's fucking surreal. It's literally surreal.
Yeah. And like, and they're majorly famous people that would, like, that I would probably be starstruck only because I'm like, oh shit, they're really famous. But like, but it's just my knowledge that they're really famous. But versus somebody who's less famous, but means a lot to me, because I really enjoy their art. You know, like if I met Taylor Swift, I'd be like, oh shit, Taylor Swift, that's really cool. Like, wow,
I've
heard Shake It Off or whatever. Like, Shake It, you know.
You talk about being a teenager a lot?
Yeah, you know. But like, if I'm a Deborah Ann Wall, who's like a character on True Blood that I was really into,
right?
Jessica, like, that, I'd be like, brr,
right?
I really liked your show. You're really good on it. Brr.
my biggest story about that is, I was in rehearsal on a TV show with James Vanderbeek, and I'd been hanging out with him for weeks, and we like become buddies. And because he's a theater dork too, and so we're talking about theater stuff all the time. And I literally left hanging out with him all day, getting paid to hang out with him, to go stand in line and pay that money I just got paid to meet Kevin Smith, who is friends with James Vanderbeek and has been for like 20 years, because he's put him in his movies. And so I'm like, oh man, I gotta go. And James Vanderbeek's like, oh, where are you headed off to? I'm like, oh, I gotta go see Kevin Smith. And he's like, you know Kevin? And I was like, no, I'd be super cool if I did. I'm gonna go pay money to buy his weed and stand in line to go like this with him. And it's just funny how that's like, first of all, that's like a very LA story, but it's also, like you said, it's about who's important to you. And I'm like eight years too young to be in love with James Vanderbeek, though he's a very nice man who I'm glad that I met. But I was like a child when Dawson's Creek was on. I don't know.
Dawson's Creek was like you said, 5 or 8 years.
Our older sisters were into that shit.
Yeah, barely.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So bartending ends up, as you per your prediction, this kind of actually touches on both of those, because you and I've talked about this on the show before, but my thing I said in high school would be dope to do is I just want to get paid to hang out with famous people, which I've clearly just expressed at some point managed to accomplish. And you were like, I'm going to be an actor in New York City and then pay my bills by being a bartender. Check. Did that. I think when you do that, and I said I wanted to work in television also, so at like about the same age you were, Comedy Central, you know, neither of us have the same goals now. So what I think is interesting is how that evolved for you. So like once you felt like you were an actor in New York City, making your money bartending until acting made you your money, what was your mentality then? How long did that sustain of like, I'm doing the thing, with also keeping in mind that Sleep No More is a bartending slash acting job, because you are meant to be in character all night. It's a very immersive kind of show. People walk up to you in character and shit. So there's an element there. How does that evolve?
I was not known as, whenever I was working there, I was not known as Brandon. I was the professor.
Right.
That was my name at Sleep No More, the professor.
So you're getting to do some.
I'd say it's evolved. Oh, that dovetails into kind of a bigger subject, which is like my journey through my acting career, where I'm at now, and like the ups and downs of it. In that, like, I was bartending to pay my bills, and then I started getting some real traction in my acting career. About a year and a half into being in New York, I got like an agent, a good agent, and I started booking some TV roles. And it was actually being at Sleep No More and being a bartender there that helped me reconnect with Tiffany Little Canfield, who's a casting director at Telsey, and she brought me in for one of my first like network auditions for like a little tiny role on the show Smash, and I booked it, which then like led the manager I was talking to sign me, who got me agents. And so I started getting
like
all this,
a domino thing.
Yeah, I started getting some real momentum. And then back in like 2014 and 2015, something like that, I was auditioning a lot for like, you know, I booked a couple co-stars, like small roles on TV shows, and then I booked like a guest star on Blue Bloods, and then my manager was like pushing me of like, we're only going in for series regulars on these shows. And then I got into the like series regular grind, which kind of sort of ate me up a bit, because the level of investment for how much you have to put in for one of those auditions versus what you get back, which is like most of the time nothing, like no notes, no response, no feedback whatsoever. And that started, it started wearing on me. And like, my manager was like, don't take like plays and unpaid. And because when I first got to New York, I was just like,
anything you could get.
Anything I can get, I just want to work. And I did a ton of graduate films at the Columbia MFA program, which built my reel for me. And I was just like, I just want to do plays or whatever. Like, I just
either
spent
way,
4 years
have to cope with the momentum of conservatory life and being like, this is my whole, I can't just go to nothing or the occasional audition.
My attitude was, I just spent 4 years paying to act, so upgrade. Acting for free is a total upgrade. And I just want to keep working the muscle.
That's a great attitude.
My first few years, I was acting constantly. A lot of it for free in the beginning, but that's how I made so many of my friends in New York City. They're my friends to this day. Like, a lot of the people that I did plays with broke Brooklyn Theater, as I like to call some of it, where like we wrote the play, we built the set, like we're doing it in an old warehouse. Like, amazing memories, you know. Like, was the play that good? Maybe not.
But, unlikely, based great. On everything we've
unlike,
heard.
Unlike, truth
okay.
be told, probably not. But it was so fun, and I mean, and genuinely made friends that have been my friends since then. And we are like kind of getting in the weeds on the acting stuff.
Sure.
But
you were going hard on the series regular thing, and it was
going hard on the series
out.
Regular thing. And it was drying me, because then I wasn't, when your entire acting career becomes just auditioning in like a little casting room with a casting director and getting no feedback. And so much of what when you, especially when you grow up in the theater, you love is rehearsal and finding it in rehearsal and doing and acting with people and working on the script with people, not just being alone with a script for hours on end. Like, we have to do that, obviously. But a couple of years of like that series regular grind, and I got close to a few things. I got to like, I got into final callbacks to play Michael J. Fox's son in his that one season, like Michael J. Fox show. And I got to audition in front of him, like, you know, get close to some stuff. But it starts grinding on you to just be auditioning. And my manager was actually being like, don't take any plays or anything because you have to be free in case there's a series regular comes along. So I took that advice, but I kind of wish I hadn't because I wasn't fueling my artist soul anymore. And it all became about the business and the break. And in retrospect, the joy started leaving it for me. I started losing the joy of what I was doing and the play, like literally the playing of doing it. And it became so much for me about like, I gotta book the thing so I can make the money. And like, and then I eventually got to, it starts creeping up on you where are you like, at least for me, I slowly started resenting the auditions. Like, oh, you got this audition for a series regular and you have 15 pages of sides that you have to prepare in the next 3 days. You need to read the whole pilot. And I was like, I'd be like, fuck, I had plans for the next 3 days and it's not like I'm going to book it. Like the jadedness starts coming in because you get no feedback. You have no fucking idea if you did well or if you did poorly or anything unless you get a callback. And just starts creeping in because I wasn't tending to my actor's soul. Like I wasn't, because you fall in love with acting by doing plays and by acting. You don't fall in love by acting by working on scripts alone and then going into a small room to do it in front of a casting director and then getting almost no feedback for months to years on end. And then in 2015 I booked a role that I thought was going to be my going to change the momentum of my acting career. I'm a big nerd. I play Dungeons and Dragons. I love that kind of stuff. And I auditioned for this movie called Paladin. And I was the lead, and it was like a budget of like a $700,000 budget feature film. And I read the script, you know, the script wasn't great, but I was like, this could be a great like movie on Netflix that people get high and watch, and it could be super fun. And I booked it, and I was so excited. It's like, I got this movie. Oh my God.
You like came out to LA and stayed with me briefly?
Yeah. At that point, I was very accustomed to the heartbreak of not getting the role. What I was kind of blindsided by was the feeling of like, oh my God, I booked this amazing thing. It's going to turn things around. And then the project being utter trash. Like, so bad. I'm not good in it. I don't need to go into tons of details, but it was really, really bad. And I joked about it at the time with a bunch of friends, but looking back on it, it really damaged my artistic enthusiasm because my dark voices started whispering, being like,
what were they saying?
This is the kind of movie that would cast you as the lead. Like this is all you deserve, bro. And I think years later, I would do The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron. And she talks about having to grieve your artistic miscarriages. Mm. And I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know how to grieve it. And I needed to. I needed to like recognize that I was so fucking excited. I was super and resultingly vulnerable because I was that excited. And when it became clear to me that it was a terrible film and I was not good at it, I needed to be able to like really process that as like the level of hurt it really was. And I think I was in denial about just how much, how sad I was about that and just how ashamed and embarrassed. And I joked with my friends, like, yeah, when it comes out, we'll like, we'll throw a party and we'll watch it and we'll like play a drinking game. Ha 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 ha. But then in the back of my head, I'm like, I'm never going to let you guys see any of you see this film. I don't want anybody to see this film. It's terrible. I'm bad in it. Why? And it that kind of broke my heart. And I, looking back, I realized that after that film, my actor spirit was in bad shape. And I didn't really recognize it because I wasn't fully honest with myself about how much that disappointment had affected me, how my self-confidence was really negatively affected. And I was getting jaded. And so I think for several years I like pulled away from acting, needed a little bit more space. So I was always doing voiceover in the meantime, just because that's just been a consistent thing. But I started focusing on just making money and then traveling as much as I could, which is how I came around to that idea of the travel show that you and I filmed together, the travel show, like pitch pilot.
Yeah.
But I recognized, I was like, and I don't think I had the full awareness of it, but like I wish that I had been able to process what was going on with like a therapist, what was going on with my actors and my artist soul, because it was really injured and really sad and bitter and embarrassed, and there's all this bad shit that took me years to kind of like, I needed some distance. I needed to like get away, like step away and not try to hustle anymore, because I was jaded, really jaded. So within all of that, like that's a very long way of saying, you know, at no point did my acting career take off in such a way as to alleviate the need to have support jobs. And at the same time, I'm here, 35 years old, in New York City, been here for 12 years, and I am still auditioning. On Monday, I'm doing a play reading in which I'm playing JFK. It's about a play about Marilyn Monroe. Like, I do 4 or 5 voiceover auditions a week on average. Like, I'm still at it. And within all of that has been a finding ways to pay my bills that I like, or at least I don't dislike, that are flexible for me, and that largely I enjoy. And so I was a bartender for a decade. Was a bartender from May of 2011 until, and I'm still technically a bartender. I mean, I still know what the hell I'm doing.
Yeah, of course, you know how to do
I was bartending all the way up until March 15th of 2020, which was the last day restaurants were open in New York City before the COVID shutdown. And I remember I had just started working this new place, and I was talking to some people, and they're like, "You're awesome. We're going to come back tomorrow and hang out with you and drink with you. Are you going to be here?" And I was like, "If we're open," which we really shouldn't be, but, and we weren't. Anyways, that was a very long side note, but
it's not a side note. That was
support.
That was the note. And I think is the answer. I have like a couple of follow-up questions to that before we probably have to cut this one. And I really appreciate, first of all, I want to say, I appreciate the vulnerability in that story, because I think that those are the kinds of stories that artists need to hear about what is coming in their future as an inevitable part of reconciling the world of business with art. But I have a couple of follow-up things that I want to mention. So thank you for sharing that and setting that up, because I actually didn't think about it going to that, but that makes sense to me. At what point in the, just so I'm super clear about this, and this can be a short answer thing. At what point in the process of working on that film did you find out that it was not going to be a project that you liked the quality of?
It was a slow realization.
Okay.
I was working with two other fellow actors who were both great. And one of them name was Taylor Rose. And Taylor knew from the first day. She was like, this is going to be a piece of crap. She's like, this is...
You saw it as cynicism.
I thought she was being so cynical. And I resented it. In the very beginning of that process, her and I did not super get along. Which is fine, because our characters also didn't either. And like the characters like grow to get along throughout the film, which to be fair is what happened with Taylor and I. Cause it wasn't a light bulb. It was a slow negotiation.
Right.
Where in the beginning I was like, this movie is going to be like, you know, a cool movie on Netflix. You can get high and watch. And then I was like, this movie is going to be like, okay, like there are going to be some good parts to it. This movie is going to be. And by the end I was like, well, right.
I've got some good,
and this is the best thing. I've got some good stage combat in it, because this guy, the fight team came in and they just took over. Like the main fight guy just, he was like, you don't have a DP? All right, I'll be the, or is, no, he, no, they had a DP. They didn't have an AD, no AD on a film. And they were like, you don't have, he, she's like, you don't have an AD? And they're like, no. He's like, okay. And he just jumped into the role of AD, and suddenly we were making a movie. Like, so like the only redeeming qualities of that film are the fact that I look cool on camera swinging swords, which is pretty cool.
That is cool. And but, I've seen that footage and you do look cool swinging the swords. Because didn't you use a tiny piece of it in a reel at some point that I saw? Cause that looked dope.
The fight scenes were the best thing I got out of it.
The second question is, and this is maybe a tough question. You don't have to answer if you want to. You said specifically, and this is what I think is maybe the most interesting part of that whole observation, because you have so many self-aware moments there that are clear to me. I don't even have follow-ups. I started to have them, then you'd answer it. But the one that I have to ask is, what makes you know that you are bad in this film? And why do you, a talented person who's lots of training and experience, how do you reconcile in your mind that you are not bad at acting, which is, like I said at the very beginning of this, the numbers don't add up, that you would be bad at it because you've been good at it so many other times. So this is like one thing that you're bad at it in. What makes you know that, and why do you think that happened?
Well, I watched myself, and right. After I did that film, I would about a year later, I would go back and I would start taking acting classes again. And I got into involved in a really, really good acting program that was Meisner based with a really good teacher. You know, our dean, you know, Gerald used to talk about it takes 20 years to become an actor, and like continuing to come back to acting training over and over again as you develop as a human and as you break through your own walls through getting older or just being like going to therapy and just figuring yourself out better. And like as you grow as a human, you grow as an actor. But then also coming back around to continuing to study and try to get better. And in that, those acting class, like I was in that for about a year and a half with a teacher who was really an incredible acting teacher, but then he misused his power and blew up the school. The school, like his acting school that he started, like collapsed because he was like, you know.
Not doing the right stuff.
Not doing the right stuff. Acting inappropriate with female students. But amazing acting training.
Sure. Two things can happen.
And looking back, I was trying really hard, you know? And pushing and like
You think it was the same energy that pushed that other actor away when they were trying to tell you it was bad?
Maybe.
It was that, like, I can't because I need the other thing to be true.
Yeah, probably. And the character is written very humorless and thought, you know, he's a paladin, if you know anything about Dungeons and Dragons, lawful good. Like, and I was pretty humorless. And then, if I'm honest, years later, there one or two random internet critics reviewed this film.
You read them.
And I read them. My acting has been described as wooden in these. And bad reviews really suck, especially when you're feeling really low and really vulnerable. You know, on the one hand, they say don't read the reviews, but boy, how can you not?
You know what it makes me think of? We both had parents, I think, that loved us very much, but also maybe had dads who weren't always great at dealing with you when things didn't work out, is an easy way to put it. And I can think of my dad. He was always the guy who was standing over me when I was learning how to do something and I would fuck up, and he'd be like, didn't quite get it there. And I'm like, I know. Like, you just like flip out because you're already so aware and angry at yourself that you failed. That just to hear a subtle, like, that was not good, is like death from someone you care about. So to hear something that is truly hurtful from a stranger kind of balance out that same thing. You're like, I know it's not good. Can you guys all just like give me a pass? Just if I can keep your mouth shut. We all agree it's not good. Silently and not you want just like the out.
And like, you know, especially since like there's a lot of my friends that don't see me act very often, and I'm like, well, I'm not going to show you this. Please don't watch this. Like, I want you to believe that I can be good. At least I want to believe that I can be good.
You learn that age-old lesson too, that every actor and most artists have to deal with, which is like, you can kind of never talk about your stuff until it's out, printed, done, and you've seen it and it's good. And then you can tell the other people it exists. Yeah. Because up to that point, it's such a gamble because you don't want to talk it up. You don't want to say it's good, and you don't want to say it means anything to you if it's not going to happen and be good.
Yeah, absolutely. You get to a place, I don't know, maybe this is a good thing, maybe it's a bad thing, where it's like, where I had to stop trying to worry about if the product was going to be very good and just try to focus on if like me doing the best acting job that I can in the circumstance, and people are like, is it going to be good? I don't know.
Right.
And sometimes you can't even tell. Like, there's one movie I worked on that I thought was going to be total trash, turned out great. This other movie I worked on that I thought was going to be great turned out trash. So much of it relies on producing. I'm not in the editing room. I'm just in front of the camera, and I hope they make me look good, and I hope that I did work well, good enough to make that easy.
And you know, that trickles down to everything else. And I hope everyone can kind of learn that lesson. For example, I've worked on shows where I'm writing comedy for people, and I'm writing comedy for them to perform in front of the camera at volume. They're making a lot of jokes, and I give them a good day's work, and I go home and be like, man, I wrote a lot of good jokes today. And then I see the thing that they've cut out of it, and I'm like, where's all the funny shit that I did? And you put in all the other stuff, and this isn't fucking funny. And I have to go, well, you fucked it up. Like, well, I still got paid. And I know I'm funny because when I walked away from the day where I wrote the jokes, I was like, I did a good job. But then they cut it into some shit. I didn't do that. That's not a sign. That's not tied to my self-esteem or my value or anything like that. And that can be really tough because at the end of the day, people are like, don't you work on that show? And I'm like, yeah, I do.
Yeah.
And they're like, it's not very funny. Aren't you the person who makes it funny? And I'm like, not the only person who makes it funny. It's a team effort, and I try my best. Team effort.
Comedy editing.
Well, it's all the same, whether it's comedy or whether it's this other movie. It's a team effort. You show up and do your best. And even if your best is mediocre, other people could make it great.
Right.
Or you could show up and do great and other people can destroy it.
Yeah. I remember one of my takeaways from watching this film that I did, while I was watching it, the main bad guy, or like the, not the main bad guy, like the sidekick bad guy, his name is Groth. And he's played by this guy, Mark, who's a very like successful actor in New York right now. He was just in on Broadway and all this other stuff. And when I watched the film, I'm like, I'm rooting for that guy. I know he's like supposed to be the evil guy, but he's very charismatic and I'm really digging his vibe. So, and my character has a stick up his ass and is really like, I don't know, totally rooting for the bad guy on this one. Hope he wins.
Can you make me a promise?
Yes. Maybe. What is it?
You can. You can. You love me very much. I love you. This is going to be a good idea. Can we watch it together? Just me and you. Please.
Yes. Because
for my
I have
birthday at some point, and you take your time. It doesn't have to be like right.
No. I have actually at this point finally processed and grieved death. The fact that I can talk about it now. I was talking with it with Jamie Boisvane, who you may recall. I was talking about it with Jamie because Jamie at the time was like living in my apartment, like splitting my room with me, because I was kind of gone a lot. And he was in New York doing a fellowship thing. And for those listening, Jamie is another friend from Austin who I've known since I was like 15 years old. Not as long as Rob, but like now in the grand scheme of things, he's been up for 20 years, like very, very, very dear friend. And he was talking about how it was really painful to be literally like splitting the room with me, watching my enthusiasm and excitement slowly disintegrate about the project. And like as my friend, it was really hard to watch because you went from so excited to like sad and jaded and fucking like heartbroken.
Right.
And we talked about it recently, like within the past 3 months, and we were like, we should have a Viking funeral for that movie. I'm ready to do a showing, show people the movie, be like, this is the thing. It fucked me up for a while, but now we shall burn it in effigy and it shall no longer hold power over me. So long, Tower of Silence, which is what it's called on Amazon. And even mentioning that, I've been hiding the real name, so like they can't find Paladin. If you're looking to watch this thing, it's called Tower of Silence. You can watch it on Amazon and it's terrible.
If the writer director
is listening, I'm sorry, man, but you should know by now that it's really bad.
100%. Here's the other thing too that I said. This is what we'll end this on, and we got to wrap up, and we'll have you back on really soon. But dude, if you can't process and grieve your own artistic miscarriages, which I think is a very interesting term to choose for that. But if you can't process that,
Julie Cameron's turn, not mine.
I have empathy and I have sympathy for you for real. But also, I'm not to be held responsible for the fact that you're not there processing it. And if your thing is objectively bad, it doesn't give me a right to necessarily be hurtful. But I'm not. And this is just my opinion. I've had close friends come to me, bring me stuff they made, and I tell them the truth without trying to hurt their feelings. Just objectively, this thing's not happening. There's no third act. It's like it never ends. It's whatever my comment is. And then they're like, don't talk to me for a while. And I'm like, I am torn between like a little part of me is like, I should just be a friend and just support them no matter what they do. And then the other part of me is like, I don't want to set the precedent of you're going to get me telling you it's great when you bring something to me, because I'm always going to try to be respectful and tell you what I really think. Cause that's why you, maybe that's not why you came to me, but that's what you're going to get. And you should, and if you want someone to like clap, no matter what, there's other people, you know, you talk to other people about that.
Well, and I think that who you bring your art to at what point in its creation is
right.
Really important. And like, don't take it and show it to the wider world before it's ready.
Yeah.
Like, and if you're going to take it in its nascent baby form to somebody, give them that context and be like, hey, like, this is still in process. I need you to tell me if any of it works. Don't tell me what's wrong with it. right now. Right. I know that things are wrong with it. I know it's not complete. I've begun this. So if I bring this to you and like, you know, I was just thinking maybe I could try and be like, that's not done. There's no things here. It's like, yeah, I fucking know. Like, I'm just started. But is there redeeming quality here worth continuing to work on, in your opinion? Right. Which is very different than
conversations.
Maybe. Which is very different from whenever you're like, I made this thing and it's ready to show the world. And if somebody you see it and you're like, I don't know if it's ready to show the world, my friend. These things can be improved, you know? So
yeah. And in either situation, you've got to also have a little armor about it. Otherwise, you are not prepared for that moment yet. Personally, if you're still like, if anything anyone says it's critical, not up to being hurtful, but critical is going to like personally hurt your feelings to where you break down inside. I think you should reconcile that before you show it to people. You know, because like, try your best to get ready for that.
Or never show it to people like I did with Tower of Silence. Because I knew. No, I'm serious. Right. People, because
like, you knew you weren't ready.
I knew that I didn't want anybody to fuck. Like, I don't want your honest opinion. I know how bad this is.
Right.
What good is it going to do for you to tell me how bad this is?
It will do you a great deal of good, Brandon. I promise you. To watch it one-on-one with me, we'll both get a little high. I'm so funny. You and I love you. And those two things together will cancel out. You're like, I know. You'll be like, he's right. And that is actually objectively hilarious about this. So I'm going to have
this. There are objectively hilarious things about it. Well, that kind of dovetails into this thing of like this idea that you're supposed to just always have this unflappable confidence in yourself. And you're like,
it's nonsense.
Talent and shit. And it's like, it's fucking nonsense. And like, I'm surrounded by, I have a lot of friends that I love very, very, very dearly. And almost none of them ever look me in the eyes and say, you're a really good actor and you should keep doing it.
Mm.
Like it's actually not encouragement that you get from almost anyone in your life. They're like, we love you and you're our friend and it's great. And and they do, and they're great. And very rarely do I ever hear somebody look me in the eye and be like, you're a really good actor and you shouldn't quit. So you just kind of come to rely on, just keep believing in yourself, even when the numbers don't support your theorem, you know?
Right. That's true. But I don't think people telling you you're good at it and that you should keep doing it is like the thing to equate to whether or not you're good at it. There's a lot of different things going on there.
Yeah, totally.
I hear what you're saying. But
reading the evidence whenever you're like, you know.
Yeah.
Just it's tough, man. It's when you're talking about like, but the numbers say, we were talking about it at the very beginning.
Yeah.
Well, it's like whenever you look at your numbers and you're like, no one casts me in any of this shit. So I'm getting the audition still, but I'm not booking like any of it. Right. So you're like, the numbers say I'm not good.
Yeah, but this is a longer conversation. We'll have to finish later because we got a gut now, but we'll come back. But we've been talking about this on the show a lot lately. And we'll get back to it. And I love you, and I'll see you soon.
Yeah, man.